welcome to the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast from the Escape Collective Podcast Network. Did I say that right, Kaylee?
I think so.
Yeah, awesome.
I think
well, this is the very first episode. I almost said welcome back, but this is the first time we're doing this, so I guess it's just welcome. You've probably heard us in the past few months on the Placeholder Podcast, and we are now growing, evolving. This is a new podcast, a brand new podcast with a really awesome name that took a lot of creativity. All credit to Kaylee on that one, by the way. Also, some major credit to Matt Deneef for that awesome music you just heard. Thanks to Matt for that. We're pretty excited about all of this. So, yeah, welcome to the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast. I'm Dane Cash. You've heard Kaylee a bit already, but I'll give you a real intro as well, Kaylee. Kaylee Fritz, welcome to the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast.
I feel like we're going to need some kind of acronym or some way, some shorter version of this.
PSBRP. That already, we already have
burp.
An acronym. Yeah.
Which, to be clear, was named because I think I was just, I needed something to reference it as in conversations with you.
But a placeholder from the placeholder.
That's how all the best podcasts
It's a literal placeholder that became a name, which that's kind of what we do here.
Very on brand.
If you're listening, you've already heard a little bit in the background there of Cosmo Catalano. Cosmo?
People have heard me before if they've been listening to the placeholder.
That's true.
I had a guest appearance across worlds. So.
Yeah. Welcome. Welcome to the PSBRP.
I am so excited to be here. I've had a lot of coffee, and I'm ready for this.
That's good, because I want you caffeinated for maximal ranting ability. And the fourth person joining us for the original inaugural Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast, episode one, Ruth Winder. Ruth, a current gravel racer. I did check beforehand to make sure I could say that was the way to introduce her. But also a lifelong cycling superstar. Let's say superstar, a national champion here in the United States of America, winner of many bike races, multi-time racer of the race we're going to talk a lot about today, Strada Bianca. Ruth, we're pretty excited to have you here. So welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk about bikes. It's so much of my life, so it's fun to be here, especially if I just get fun introductions like that.
I'll try to keep it fun every week. I may have to come. I'll be scrolling through PCS to find a new result to hype maybe every week.
I'm all for it.
It is super handy to have bike racers on the podcast when PCS exists, because I can always check like, all right, when's so and so's birthday, and what race did they win? You mentioned being excited to talk about bike racing, and I'm very excited to talk about bike racing. And I know that Cosmo's always excited to talk about bike racing. Mm-hmm. And as I noted to Kaylee a few minutes before the podcast started, I think we're all just very excited to talk about bike racing. I know I'll just talk about it to anybody who will listen. And I think we wanted to have a little section here to tell people what the heck we're doing here. We're coming to you on this first episode on the feed that you've been listening to, the placeholders and the geek warning. What are we doing here? What are we doing at the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast? And I figured the best person to answer that might actually be Kaylee, because we'll just talk about bike racing to anybody who'll listen. Kaylee, why are you giving us a platform? That's the real question. I think that's what people probably should know about.
I think the answer is quite simple, which is that we know that there are a lot of people out there who want to hear us talk about bike racing and would like to hang out with us in their ears talking about bike racing. And to be perfectly honest, the placeholders is a little bit less of a serious bike racing podcast. It's not even close to pretty serious, I would say. In fact, there are tangents galore, and we kind of go off on lots of weird little avenues into dead ends. And yeah, it's you know, we've never been all that focused on like racing analysis and really digging into the how and the why things happened in bike racing. Placeholders has always been more about what are the big stories of the week, and let's talk about those and make sure we keep people informed and hopefully slightly entertained. This would be a pretty serious bike racing podcast. I mean, you know, does what it says on the tin. I think that's a good way to think about this one. And yeah, it fits in with the rest of the sort of Escape Collective podcast network, I think, pretty well. Side note, if you're listening to this, you're subscribed to the Placeholders podcast probably. Now would be a good time, if you haven't already, to go sign up for Escape Collective, because we are still in our founding phase. We are not, as of yet, to our target, which means, I hate to have to reiterate this, if we don't get there, all of this disappears into the ether with a soft scream. And so I would really appreciate it if you would head over to escapecollective.cc and sign yourself up. If you like this podcast, if you like our other podcasts, to keep them going, we need your support. So please go do that. Is that an adequate explanation, Dane?
Yeah, and I would second the thing you just said about you know, going over, signing up, because I don't want this to disappear in the ether. We just started. Like, we got to have at least a few episodes.
It'd be sad.
You know? Yeah, it'd be real sad. Well, thanks for telling us why we're here. That's good. That's good to know. I'm glad to now know why I'm here. And we could just get into talking about bike racing. It is the pretty serious bike racing podcast. And we were very lucky to have some pretty serious bike racing over the weekend. Some pretty serious bike racing that was, I thought, very entertaining. I thought we had two great editions of Strada Bianca, the White Roads. And why don't we just talk about it? That's what we're here for. So I figure we'd talk about the women's race first. It did happen first. And that was a very entertaining event. It was a race that really kind of came down to the wire. And that was that kept it interesting throughout, although always this race is interesting throughout. I would say that we are typically watching races that are interesting throughout it at Strada. Cosmo, before we go any farther, I didn't put this in the run sheet. I meant to, and I forgot. So it's not in the run. You're not going to be prepared for this. I just figured I was going to ask you without any preparation, could you give us like a 20-second explainer on like maybe how this race was taken to victory?
I like how you phrased that.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's we got 46K of coverage, which is pretty solid for Women's World Tour race. And what we started with was very stop and start racing, a lot of either very aggressive unsustainable attacks or riders sitting all across the road looking at each other. Around 40K from the finish, Kristen Faulkner from Jayco Alula went clear in a way that was very much not a unsustainable attack. It took her, I think, about 2 kilometers to catch one rider who was off the front. So very kind of steady pace. And behind her, kind of the start and stop really continued until about 20K to go. And Movistar and SD Works really set up on the Colle Panzuto climb / gravel section. I don't quite know what to call it because it's sort of both.
We need a handy name. Like, there's got to be some kind of handy name for that, but I don't know what it is.
I'm sure we should. I bet if we talked to RCS and said we need a handy name to describe these combination sector climbs. It was a pretty obvious, tactically important point in the course, and a lot of people attacked, and you ended up with a group of about 7 going clear. Annemiek van Vloten from Movistar, Cecilia Utrip-Ludwe from Suez FDJ, I think is the name of their team. Park Petersen was there, and they all kind of got clear, stabilized, and then Dami Vollering from SD Works took off. Kopecky was in the group behind to watch attacks for her. She went clear about 17K to go, and all of a sudden, there was a horse in the middle of the race course.
We're going to get to that. Yeah? Like, we got a whole horse segment coming
nice.
Up.
Nice. Okay.
I did write horse on the course in all caps in the run sheet. Yeah.
So the horse was on the course. The horse went off the course. The next climb, the last gravel section, Kopecky, her teammate, somewhat surprisingly came across, and the two did a team time trial to the bottom of the final climb where they caught Faulkner. It was not the smoothest catch I've ever seen. We'll probably talk about that. And then once they both got past her, they really seemed to have a pretty legit race against each other last 100-some-odd meters of the race. Vollering just pipped Kopecky, did not look very happy or seem very happy about it. Really kind of interesting, exciting, nail-biting sort of finish. I was stoked on it.
All right, so long story short, another dominant finish from SD Works, even if it didn't necessarily, it wasn't obvious that was going to happen with even 10 minutes to go. It was still kind of unclear, I thought. Lots of things to talk about. First thing I have here on our list of things to talk about, do we think anybody could have done anything against the SD Works 1-2? Was there a way to tactically play this that something else could have happened, or was this going to happen?
I mean, Faulkner kind of almost did it. Like, we'll probably talk about this more in the horse section, but it was not entirely clear prior to Kopecky bridging that Vollering was going to close the gap down. The horse definitely expanded the gap. You know, the horse came on, I think she was about a minute down. The horse went away. She was like 120 down. But I, you know, I saw a lot of things in this stop and start racing that I think especially a lot of teams, especially Phoenix Alpecin, could really, if they can coordinate a little bit better, they can really make a dent, I think, in SD Works. Park Peters is very excited about racing bikes, it seems like. She finished, I think, sixth and was like pumping her chest and like swinging her arm as she came across the line. And I think if she and Christina Schweinberger, who is very active kind of following these attacks, if they can coordinate a little bit better, I think they could definitely break up some of what SD Works is doing. That doesn't mean they're going to, you know, be there on equal footing, but I think there's definitely a chance to make things a little more interesting from a team tactics point of view.
Yeah, because up to this point, I mean, SD Works has done what they've done year in, year out. I mean, there were maybe 2 years there where the Bowles Domans squad that they used to be didn't have quite the same level of results, but they've been awesome to start the year, and I'm just kind of curious what other teams are thinking right now about that. All right, you mentioned the horse and the course. We don't have to talk too much about the horse and the course, but I wanted to note that the horse and the course made the non-cycling media. You know, I saw stories that were from websites and outlets that don't cover cycling. And I had this thought as I was reading those headlines, which is that those things happen enough in the sport that I didn't... there was a horse in the course. It was wild. I'm like, wow, there's a horse. And then the horse was gone. And then I didn't really think about it anymore. And that happens a little bit too much in cycling. It's a little weird.
I mean, Ruth, as somebody who's been in a bike race, I don't think with a horse, has anything weird jumped in front of you in a bicycle race before?
I mean, the classic dog on the course, you know, maybe a pedestrian that didn't somehow get the cue that there was a bike race coming through. But like, no, that was the first time. And I couldn't help but think like, oh my gosh, what would I have done if I was her, like in that situation? Like, what do? You can't ride to, like, what if the horse turns into you? It's much scarier than like a little dog or something like running alongside you. It's this huge, massive horse. So she screamed and you could hear it on the audio, and I would have too. It would have been terrifying, and I love horses, but I still would have been like just so scared in the moment, I think.
I was pretty impressed how she handled it. I mean, she just kept racing and fast, and the horse eventually fell. The horse is okay. The horse took a corner a little too hot, as if it were the Giro. It got up, and as far as we know, I'm only making these jokes because as far as we know, the horse is fine. I wouldn't.
It was confirmed. Somebody on Facebook confirmed that the horse is fine.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Because like I don't want to kick it while it's down. Okay.
Yeah.
To me, it was just sort of just another example where these stories make the other media outlets that aren't covering cycling, and people ask me about them. They say, "Oh, wow, there was a horse, and what happened? What happened to the horse? What happened to the race?" And I just say, it was on the course, then it wasn't on the course, and then they just kept going. And yeah, that happens all the time. Maybe it's not a horse, but yeah, there's dogs. There's fans holding signs into the middle of the road, and they're like the biggest news story about the Tour de France, apparently. But I feel like as a racing fan, we just see it maybe a little too much. I don't know. I guess that's what makes our sport so interesting.
I want to return to a previous question, Dane. I want to return to your what else could teams do question, right?
Yeah.
Because if you pulled up the last 3K of this race, you would have been like, well, you know, that feels inevitable. SD Works was far and away the strongest team in the race, and then nothing else is going to happen. But you also mentioned there that Faulkner was able to get like a sizable lead solo because of this sort of stop-start nature of what was happening behind. And I don't know, Ruth, I'd like your take on this as well. Like, was that a moment of really good timing? Was it a moment that others could have taken advantage of? Was it just the fact that it was just her going that led to that kind of not working in the end, but coming pretty close? I mean, pretty really, really close to working. Like, what was it about that moment and that attack, which, Dane, I think you said earlier, it was a bit of a weird one that kind of went slowly, or what was Cosmo, a bit of a weird kind of slow attack. How did that work? Why did that work? ish.
I think to me, it's at a point, right? Like we'd just had Swing Cold off the front with an attack, so they'd already kind of gotten used to the fact that maybe somebody was up the road. It's at a moment where you're on a big paved road. It's kind of smooth. People are probably eating and drinking. You have 40K left to go, so everyone's just getting mentally prepared for like the really, really hard part of the race that's about to come. And then they're probably like, oh, it's Faulkner. Like, yeah, she's really strong. We'll keep an eye on it. But, like, we don't need to go with her right now. We're waiting for a more kind of, I guess, iconic moment to be going on the steep dirt climb, something like that. So people just kind of, like, let it go a little bit just because it's like, oh, I don't want to work. And most of the time at that point, a lot of the domestiques have done a lot of work. They're not there anymore. The peloton is smaller. I still felt like it was a pretty good-sized peloton at that time, but, like, a lot of the workers have been gone and have been given a specific job to make sure that their lead rider is in position going into the next gravel section. So then when she went, and then you could definitely see Movistar and SD Work start to do a lot more work as we got a couple more kilometers down the road. And then, yeah, I think like actually as it reduced, the only thing that I think would have been interesting to see what would have changed would have been if Annemiek van Vleuten wasn't even in the race, because although she wasn't like performing maybe as the way we have seen her in the past, just being there is just like a deterrent to everybody. It's like everybody else is just like, oh, she won't want to lose, so she'll do it. Or she also had a teammate in Liana Lippert who's proved to be super strong lately. So, you know, if you were the one without a teammate, like Nivea Doma, I'm not sure that Puck really knows. She's super strong, obviously, but maybe she's still learning. It kind of shows she does like a lot of work necessarily when she doesn't have to. So there was that. And then Cecilia, like if they hadn't had those other characters close to them, maybe there wouldn't have been hesitation. It did seem like they struggled on the climb anyway. So who really knows if that would have been an option to go with Kopecky when she bridged over to Demi. But I do think that by her just being there, that she was, yeah, just a deterrent.
My big what if is Marta Cavalli, because I feel like Utrip Ludwig was so close to bridging up to the two SD Works riders, and with another strong contender on her team in the group there, I think we're looking at a totally different tactical situation in the finale. So
we should talk about that, the catch, the moment where Faulkner was caught was there was argy bargy. Which is, I don't know, one of my favorite Britishisms. I've really come to love that one.
I don't know if you can hear it in Ruth's accent there. She, you know, British parents.
Born in England, yeah.
Yeah, you're born in England. Maybe you can give us a brief history of the Argy Bargy, some other episode we're not going to do right now.
Well, I do also want to get your take, though. I mean, on the level of Argy Bargy, where do you rate that, Ruth? Was that acceptable Argy Bargy? Was it unacceptable Argy Bargy?
I mean, I'm still kind of giggling it when we bring it up, because I think she was just probably so dead at the time that she was like, oh no, what's happening? And I was like, oh, I'll close the door, because it didn't make a difference in anything at the end of the day. And it was just a little bit funny to watch to me. I was just like, oh no, what's happening? But it wasn't, I mean, you can close a door if you want to close a door, but they weren't sprinting, and we've seen it, like, I remember... what was it at the time, whatever SD Works, way back when Mara Abbott was racing the Giro, and they all like boxed her in, and Mara didn't know what to do, so she like chucked her water bottle on the ground. So like, I've seen it in racing before, like, but I mean, in the end it didn't change anything. I think it was just her being trying to do everything she could.
It was like she closed the door in a wall full of doors. Like, there were more doors elsewhere. So it didn't really matter. Okay, that door closed. Yeah. Bullring's like, there's another door to your left. I don't know if you knew that, Kristen, but I'm going to go that way instead. So in the end, yeah, like you said, there's not a massive impact on the finale, although maybe sort of a frustrating moment and a bit of, like, you know, even a small gap, because there was a bit of a gap there that was then created to Kopecky. Even a small gap, when you're that fried, you're not going to want to close it. And she had to. So,
I mean, we saw how close that finish was, right? Like, that another elbow or two, or she, you know, Vollering rides, really tries to force that issue and maybe, like, bangs into Faulkner's rear wheel and really has to... Because she kind of, like, eased off after she bumped into the fencing, rode back around, caught up to Kopecky. But, like, that costs you a lot. And when the margin is that close at the line, you have to imagine that every little extra effort is taking something out of you. But as far as the argy bargy itself goes, from my uninformed category 3 perspective, like, one of my pet peeves is someone riding in a place that is objectively not a good place to ride and then getting mad when something bad happens to them. And, you know, I think Vollering saw a space to ride and just figured that Faulkner wasn't going to move over. And then when she moved over, you know, really, really tried to force her way through there when she clearly didn't. She wasn't in a place where she could realistically push her way through. So it was just, for me, it was just it was a very stubborn kind of from both riders. It looked stubborn, at least to me. And I think that's, you know, part of that is like, that's what it takes to be a pro racer, is that level of hard headedness. But no, I was a little bit surprised how mad the internet was, which I maybe should never be, but there were a lot of people who were kind of calling for Faulkner's head. And I was like, whoa, like, this is a racing incident. This is okay.
I feel like if she'd swerved another time, then that might have been valid.
Yeah.
But like a single swing over the right, I mean, you could absolutely make the argument that like at the first swing, she didn't really know.
She didn't look back.
What was happening. She didn't look back. You know, she was just swinging, right? Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, if you watched any of the riders that were coming in behind them, there was plenty of swinging happening, right? Like, people are literally like postmanning across up that climb. So I don't. Not like the classiest move I've ever seen to stick an elbow like that, but at the end, I've seen far worse. And to be honest, when you're going like 8 miles an hour up a final climb into Siena, the consequences for something like that are relatively low as well.
Yeah, that climb is super steep. I feel like it's steep enough that I'm willing to kind of give anybody a pass for a momentary lapse on a climb like that. All right, well, you mentioned, Cosmo, what happened next, which was the sprint. And to me, that I really enjoyed watching a teammate head to head. I don't have any like major qualms that I'm gonna write a big story about with teammates deciding not to do that and say, okay, you get to win this one. And I feel like every so often that happens, where teammates decide, okay, nice job, and you can take the win. But I do really want to see more of what we saw, which is two teammates racing each other. And it's fun. It was dramatic. It was close. And I kind of hope we get more of that.
So I posted a little bit about this on the Escape Instagram, and somebody made a good point, which is that neither of them looked happy at the finish line, which tells me that yes, they were racing each other, but there was some communication errors somewhere in there. And I'm gonna read a quote out from Vollering. In the moment that I looked around to celebrate with her, she overtook me. Then I was like, is she doing a lead out for me? But then I felt she was really going for it. And I was like, okay, we're not teammates anymore. Right. So there was a bit of a, and I guess part of the reason why she looked so put out at the finish line, Vollering, I mean, is that she thought she lost that. And she thought that essentially she'd been pipped by a teammate who had gone immediately into combative mode as opposed to celebratory mode that she was kind of ready for. So, you know, bad taste in everybody's mouth it means that something probably went a little bit wrong. And I would agree with you, Dane, that I think I would prefer to see them race it out than, you know, rock, paper, scissors across the finish line, which we've seen elsewhere. But that didn't seem like, I would rather they turn to each other and go, we're sprinting. And then it happens, right? As opposed to what appeared to be a sort of semi sneaky maneuver by Capecchi.
I think it would make sense if you had a situation where a director comes over the radio and says, you guys are away, you're going to sprint for it, go for it, whoever wins, wins, and have fun with it, whatever. But going into Siena, they were still making the catch, and then the catch was made on that stupidly steep gradient, double digits, where there's fans lining the road. I'm assuming the communication was just much harder than normal. I mean, it's not like they were off the front in a break that was clearly going to succeed, you know, and they knew that 10 minutes from the finish. They only really knew 1 minute from the finish line that they were going to be contesting the win. So it makes sense that they wouldn't have done much communication beforehand. I feel like that would be a poor form to be discussing whether you're going to sprint each other for the win before you've made the catch. I think what could have been smart to do it, but I think it would have been bad form to do that. So I get why they didn't.
Ruth, I want your take on it. What do you think?
I just think, as a director, what would you tell them? Just be like, okay, well, you're both really strong. You both really want to win. And to me, too, in that, I was trying to also, again, put myself in that situation, right? Like, if I'd been in a race, what would I have done? And to me, on my team, I was a smaller rider. I wasn't, you know, Lizzie Dagnan. You know, I wasn't Elisa Longo-Borghini. I was Ruth. So if I had been in that situation with these superstars on my team, I would have just assumed they were going to win. You know, it wouldn't have really been a question. But, you know, Vollering and Capecchi are kind of more on the same level. They both have won really big races. They both have this ego. And neither of them are going to look at each other and be like, oh, yeah, I don't get paid nearly as much as you do to do this job. Obviously, you're going to win. So they looked at each other and were like, I want to win this race. Like, I'm not going to back down. And so I just, what would you say? Like, how would you, as even as a director in the radio, say like, okay, do this? So to me, I'm just, I don't, yeah, okay, maybe they should have chatted. But again, there wasn't really any time to chat about it. I also wouldn't have felt that they would talk about it before they caught Faulkner because it was so close. I'm sure they both had confidence they were going to catch her. But yeah, I don't know how you really discuss it. And to me, it did seem like Demi was just going as hard as she could up that climb. And then when Capecchi came around, she was a bit surprised.
Kelly, you mentioned that they both looked upset. And I actually thought that Capecchi looked like smiling and like, man, what a rousing finish. And Vollering looked over like WTF, like very like, what did you just do kind of thing. It was interesting to watch the post-race interviews with Vollering because Eurosport had a reporter basically there to tell her, hey, you're the winner. And she was still very kind of cold and sort of warmed up to like, okay, I won, I'm happy now. And you could see the things she sort of said, like her attack went at 17K, and she was very specific, like how we discussed, like that was the pre-race plan. And she kind of, the way she described Capecchi coming across on the next climb was very, like she was said literally, then suddenly Lotta was with me. And then Lotta's a killer. I was a bit surprised by her action. It was a bit excited in the finish. Very much, it seemed to me like she was completely taken aback by everything that happened kind of from 10K on. And very much like, she said something in the official winner's interview where she was very much like, I really like this race. And she kind of cried a little bit because I think it was Chantel Black who told her like, hey, you need to believe in yourself, like you can do this race. And she had all these things happen, like that horse jumping out in the course, the surprise arrival of her teammate, who is objectively, I think on paper, a faster sprinter than her, to kind of have all that happen and to kind of come into the finish and still win this race. Like it's an emotional journey, I feel like.
To me, one of the biggest standouts is the fact that no matter what happens with whoever is standing on top of the podium, it's just another big win for SD Works, by the way. And the team has been great to start the year, as they so often are. When we were planning the podcast, I was trying to come up with fun segments to do. And one thing that I really want to do in this show is talk about some unheralded performances. And Cosmo, as you pointed out, there was a performance from the SD Works team that may be a little bit less heralded than, you know, finishing on the top step of the podium or in second. So, yeah, your unheralded rider for the race, Cosmo. Actually, you know what? First, let's go do a little sound effect. I'm gonna go look for a sound effect here. All right, here we go. Da-da-da-da! All right, Cosmo, your unheralded rider for this race. Go for it.
Mishka Bredewald, I think I'm saying that correctly, of SD Works, did a ton of, during that stop-start racing, really worked hard to keep everything together, and then made a big effort at the bottom of the Colle Pinzuto to really line things out to set up the eventual contenders in the race. And I think it's easy to talk about how strong SD Works is based on, you know, these superstar riders, but there are a lot of people setting things up and making sure they can perform at their max. So I thought that she had a great day.
I think they've done a really nice job of that throughout their existence, whether they've been SD Works or Bulls Domans, in having not just the, now it's the Vollerings and the Capecchis, and it used to be a long list of stars, really, Van der Breggen and Chantal van der Broek Black, and then before that, Dagnan. Yeah, but they've always also had just quite a few really strong riders who have been willing to kind of put their own ambitions aside for the team, and I think that's a big part of the reason why they've been such a dominant squad. It's just such a strong team, top to bottom. And there's only, I think, only a handful of other teams, I think you can really say that, just top to bottom, they've got stars at the top, and also a lot of quality in sort of the domestiques as well. Anyway, thanks for heralding. I think we should do as much heralding as we can so I can make that stupid sound as often as I can. All right. I think we've covered the bases for Strada Bianca women. Do we want to jump into Strada Bianca men? And if so, without any preparation, Cosmo, would you be willing to give us a 30-second rundown, just a really quick rundown of what it was that led to the winning of the race?
I can attempt to do so.
Okay.
I think we got coverage from about 90K. There was a three-rider break. Around 50K to go, Alberto Bettiol jumped out of the group. Got a little bit of a response, I think, from Bagioli on Quickstep Soudal, and also one Tom Pidcock.
He also got a response from Kaylee in our text messages. You quote, like a spicy Bettiol.
Is that said so like that's a spicy meatball?
That's what I assume. Yeah.
So I have Italian heritage. I can say things like that.
There we go. And yeah, so he drew a response from multiple people, including Kaylee.
I was actually surprised at the relatively small size of the response, especially given where Pogacar had attacked in a last year's race. Those guys got away. It was pretty calm until Vanderpool basically attacked the feed zone at 42K to go and then didn't really do anything after that except consume camera time. There were a series of attacks that he did not or was not able to follow, eventually ending with a group of about six riders around 35K to go.
Can I make a very small Vanderpool point? I mean, it was obvious that he was off his game a little bit, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you know, 95%, whatever it is. But if we didn't have enough proof from just the result and all the watching him get dropped that we got to do in the sort of 15, 20 minutes afterward, I feel like when you're feeling good, and Ruth, correct me if I'm wrong here, when you're feeling really good, you don't tend to pick the feed zone as your attack point. Like the slow part, right? Like, generally, the people that attack at the slow bits, one, it's you're kind of doomed generally, and two, it's because they're like, oh, thank God, it's slow, and I'm going to go fast now, right? And so, in general, Vanderpool would be one of those type of riders that would attack at the very hardest moment of the race and use that to sort of break the elastic, and the fact that he was attacking in the feed zone was just yet another bit of proof that he's not quite probably where he would like to be right now.
Okay. So yeah, around 30K to go. I should say Pidcock caught up to the break. 30K to go, a group of six riders are behind him trying to chase and not doing a very good job, particularly two Jumbo riders, Atish Benoit and Attila Valters.
Coolest name in my opinion. Attila is a pretty cool name. Race. If your name is Attila, like, you have to have a really cool name to beat that, in my opinion. So good on Attila Valter.
We're going to have a little bit more on Attila on this week's placeholders, because Johnny actually went and hung out at his house when Giro started in Hungary and, like, chatted with his boyhood, you know, bike mechanic and a bunch of other interesting stuff. So anyway, tune into that one later this week.
Well, he was super strong. He just didn't seem to be on the same page as Benoit. And this was a pretty strong group of riders. I would say Benoit, Valter, Quinn Simmons, Maddie Mohoric, Madois. Is that, I'm missing somebody in there? Rui Costa. Rui Costa was in there too, kind of defying his 36
Blast
years
from
of age.
The past. Yeah. Blast from the past. I he's won more bike races this year than most. So I was kind of surprised, but also kind of not surprised to see him up there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they came within literal seconds of Pidcock. They had him in sight, I think kind of dead to rights on a few sections of road and just couldn't get it together. And Pidcock really kept his head on straight. Like, he kept feeding, he kept taking food, he kept riding smart, didn't blow himself up trying to get away, did very good descending, very competent use of the energy he had, and kind of as they sat up, really put in a big dig around 2K to go, and suddenly had 30 seconds on the bottom of the climb into Siena and never looked back. He also seemed completely wrecked in the post-race interview, like in a way, beat up in a way that I don't think I've ever seen him. Like, normally he's pretty peppy, feisty post-race interview, and he was almost struggling to put sentences together. So I think he went all in on that one.
I feel like one of the great things about Strada is the way that it beats you up in multiple ways, because there's the climb at the end, so obviously that's very demanding. But then there's also the terrain. There's the dust. Like, you get to the end of that race, and I would think you'd be pretty beat up. I mean, okay, if I did any World Tour race, if I did any, like, Cat 4 race, I'd be beat up. But this race, more than most, I think, really does a number on people, and it was a well-earned win for Pidcock, who I thought kind of needed a win like this. In the bike media, I mean, we talk about Pidcock all the time. He's obviously an extremely talented bike racer who can win not just road races. He happens to be a decent mountain biker and a decent cyclocross racer.
He reigning Olympic champion.
He happens to have some medals.
Until a month ago, reigning
some gold,
world cyclocross champion.
But at the same time, when it comes to road racing, he's often been up there in the last year. He's been there or thereabouts, which is another one of my favorite Britishisms, in a lot of races. But the actual big wins have been kind of hard to come by for him so far. He's had a few, but not that many. And I think for him to win at Strada like this was a big deal, because it kind of cemented, okay, he's not just an Olympic champion, not just the cyclocross champion. I think he really is this year. I think one of those things where you can build on wins, I think that's going to happen for him. I see that. I see good things for this Tom Pidcock kid.
I think he won because of his descending.
Ooh, yeah. And I think that is something that maybe isn't that surprising because of his skill set.
Yeah. I'm not even just talking about when he was initially creating that gap where, you know, there's that shot of him passing the motorcycle. That's pretty wild. That certainly helped, right? The couple seconds he got there. But if you'll recall, like, there were a couple other riders sort of in and about him, and you know, he caught up to that group that was in front, and he basically got rid of everybody going down, with the exception of Alessandro DeMarchi, who he finally got rid of going up. But I mean, just think about how much energy you save by taking just a couple seconds every single time you go down a hill, and essentially, you know, not being able to soft pedal on the way back up, but you have those free seconds, right? And he can lose a little bit on the way up and save a bit of energy, and then get those seconds right back on the way down. And the time gaps are always sort of notoriously shaky in RCS races and in Strade Bianche in particular. But it was clear, even just by watching sort of the gaps, but not the time gaps, but like watching literally the distance between, particularly early on, between him and other groups, he was taking significant time for free, right? For no extra energy expenditure whatsoever. And I think that was huge if you look at sort of the gap at the end there, which ended up not being that big. And as you said, Cosmo, he was very nearly caught a couple different times. A couple seconds here or there, I think, was the difference. And it came from an incredible skill set.
I think another thing that he didn't waste energy on, got some free energy on maybe, he didn't look back like at all. And you mentioned that, Cosmo, but I think old school bike racers and DSs were probably very pleased with this final 20 minutes, because he was not looking back to check the gap. He was focused on moving forward the whole time. And when he did look back, it was so noticeable that he hadn't been, that I thought, wait, wow, he did that. He actually looked back. It was like one or two times in the entire final 20 minutes, maybe. And I think that, to me, again, that says a lot about his drive, and I think it's also just sort of where he is right now. He's really, really motivated to win a bike race, and he's going to give everything to do that. And yeah, he went out and won it at Strada. I am a little curious. I mean, you mentioned, Cosmo, the lack of cooperation a little bit from the two Jumbo riders. They were the team that had firepower in numbers. I mean, it was two riders instead of one. It wasn't like they had eight. I'm curious, because when I'm watching this race, I'm thinking, even if these two collaborate, which they should have, one of them should have ridden for the other one, I think, I still don't know if they would have caught Pidcock. I mean, it was that close that, yeah, that might seem like it's an obvious thing that they could have caught Pidcock. At some points, it was so close. But to me, it seemed like neither one was that strong enough to be pulling Pidcock back. I don't know. What do you all think? Could they have caught Pidcock if they worked together?
Yeah, I think they would have, purely just because if they'd worked together, then it would have motivated everybody. So it wouldn't have just been two people chasing him back. It would have been that whole bunch of people chasing them back. But because the two of them obviously weren't working together, it just, again, neutralized everybody else, because everyone else was like, well, I'm alone without a teammate, so why would I pull your butt up here to him to just get beaten by you in the finish? So I think they would have come back, but I don't think that they would have beaten Pidcock. I think he was on a day where it would have been so hard to beat him, and I think like him not looking back to the whole time just is even more evidence of how good he felt. And he said in his post-race interview that he knew that week he was going to have a great day, and so I think he would have got caught, and I think it could have been really exciting if he had been, but I still think he would have won.
I would agree. There was a moment, and I don't have the kilometer mark in front of me, but it was very close to the end, where Valter got dropped, clawed his way back, and instead of just hitting the front and driving it and beginning to start that sort of rotation and beginning to pull a couple seconds back, he kind of like sat in the back for a minute, recovered, and then attacked again, right? And it was when him and Tiege Benoot were kind of going back and forth. And that, to me, felt like the one moment where, like, you can try the 1-2 thing, right, as teammates, see if you can get somebody up the road or something, although I would say that the priority should have been getting Pidcock back first. But it was clear at that point that the 1-2 wasn't going to work, right? So at that point, Valter, who had just been dropped, it was on him to hit the front and just empty it, right? Empty the gas tank and see how close you can get. And I think it basically showed that they didn't have enough confidence in Benoot and his ability to get up that climb in front of the rest of that group. Or it was a function of Valter just sort of being on a completely different wavelength. But that's what it showed to me, is that they didn't have that plan settled well enough. And maybe the directors weren't in their ear sternly enough. And as a result, the second I saw him attack, I was like, ah, it's over. Pidcock's got it, right? It was immediate from that moment.
To me, that's sort of a rare occurrence from Jumbo. I think we've generally seen them be very well marshaled across their many, many different talented riders. They tend to do a pretty good job of working for each other, putting, for instance, a Wout van Aert to work for somebody else. I was a little bit surprised at that kerfuffle. The lack of cooperation was just surprising. You don't see that from this team very often.
Well, Benoit was like waving his arms around. he was annoyed. Yes. Like, he was really annoyed. And that kind of comes back to what you were talking about earlier, Ruth, which is like, I mean, Valter's like, he's a good rider, but he is not Tiege Benoot, right? And so at some point he should have probably realized that and said, my job is now to help my teammate out, who makes three times as much money and everybody's actually heard of, and try to get them to the finish line. And he never did that. So I would imagine that there were some stern words after the finish line and in the Jumbo team bus, because I can't imagine that went as they would have liked it to.
Yeah, during the broadcast, as I was watching, I was thinking it was a 7 of 10 performance. The waving of the hands from Tiege Benoot, the gesticulations, and I figure if that's what we're seeing on TV, that probably was not a great conversation in private. I'm assuming he was not happy. Yeah. All right. So Jumbo, maybe not doing everything they could, but maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe Pidcock wins anyway. I did have a little bit of a. I think we can mention an unheralded rider. I don't know if I'm going to do the sound for you, Kaylee, because the guy finished second. so he's a little bit heralded, I feel like. I don't know that he needs a whole horn here.
He's relatively heralded.
But Valentin Madouas was a very impressive rider on the day, the 26-year-old from Groupama FDJ. And I know you like him, Kaylee, because you tend to like riders of his classification.
Doomed and French. Yes. I really love a good doomed Frenchman. And so the reason why I have him as my sort of unheralded rider for this particular day, one, because none of us really did much heralding of him prior to this particular one day race, I should say. But the other reason is because nobody else in the group he was in seemed to herald him particularly much, right? He just kind of floated the entire time. And part of the reason, I was just watching him and he was pulling less. He was super calm, super collected. not a name in that particular group that was getting mentioned all that much. I mean, Mohorič and Benoit were definitely getting mentioned a heck of a lot more by the commentators. Were doing a lot more, were a lot more active. But Madouas was just sitting in the right spot the entire final 50K and never really stuck his nose in the wind, never had to close any massive gaps. And, well, we saw the result, right? I mean, he was the first post Tom Pidcock into Siena. So a relatively heralded rider with a low-key performance that ended up with a fantastic result.
And from that same team, and I think this is a theme we're seeing from Groupama in general, which is this team starting to really care about the classics, because Madouas now has finished on the podium at Flanders and Strada. I was very impressed with the ride, maybe not surprised with the ride, but impressed with the ride of Romain Grégoire, who finished eighth at Strada. And I think it's worth noting that this is a team, Groupama, that has not really had too much success turning young prospects into big stars. The main reason being that they just don't get many of the young prospects. Those riders go to Ineos and UAE and Jumbo lately. But Grégoire is a really major young talent. He's 20 years old, and he won the younger rider versions of Liège, and he won, I think he won the Baby Giro. He won a stage at L'Avenir. And for them to get him to sign with Groupama and not one of those other teams that I mentioned that tends to get those young prospects, I think that's a big get for this Groupama team. And yeah, he went out and showed at Strada. He's already top 10 at Strada material, despite being, he literally just turned 20 in January. I'm very impressed in general with the way that Groupama FDJ has really, worked hard to kind of build that classic squad into something that could be respectable and maybe get a big result here.
I look forward to Grégoire joining the list of doomed Frenchmen. He's not quite doomed yet, but he'll get there. He'll get there. I want to talk about Rui Costa because I just, if you go check out like the pro cycling stats, like current rankings, right, which are not exactly the same as the UCI rankings. They're actually, I think, a little bit more sophisticated. He's currently number one for the season thus far. And this is Rui Costa we're talking about. So for those who have only followed the sport sort of in the last couple of years, you may not even know who this is, right? Like, he's been almost completely silent since his kind of heyday in, would have been 2012, 2013 was really his year, 2014. And he kind of went pretty quiet since 2014, which I will remind you is 9 years ago now. And all of a sudden he's back. He's fourth at Strada Bianca and is the number one rider in the world at the moment, according to Pro Cycling Stats. What's going on with Rui Costa?
I guess it's the Intermarché Circus Wanty magic touch. He left UAE after 6 years there. More than that, because he was with Lamprey forever, or for a few years before that. So maybe it was just the change of scenery. Did him good. Because, yeah, it wasn't just Strada, because he won the Volta a la Comunitat Valenciana. He was pretty good in the Algarve, in his home country of Portugal. And I, for one, am very excited to see Rui Costa doing well, because I actually really like Rui Costa. And I think if you watch enough bike races, you will hear commentators make comments about Rui Costa's style. Then you will pretty quickly pick up on the fact that everybody talks about him like a wheel sucker, which I think he probably is.
Do you know where that comes from? It comes from the 2013 World Championships.
Which I thought he did a damn good job that year of winning that bike race, and everybody talks about it like Spain lost, which is, first of all, they had to be a winner. And second of all, he played those two riders very well.
Yes.
Valverde and Joaquin Rodriguez that year. In any case, I think if you're good at that, that's fine. That can be your thing. You can be good at riding in people's wheels and winning bike races. There's nothing wrong with that.
I'm happy to see him back. I just didn't realize he was still racing. That's mean. That's mean of me to say. But it's kind of actually true. Like, I mean, he's been pretty anonymous for a couple of years, and whatever it is that he's figured out, that he's, you know, in a happy place again, great, because he's an entertaining bike racer, and I like entertaining bike racers.
I kind of hope he can hold it through to June, because that's when the Tour de Suisse is, And he is, to me, he's like the undisputed greatest Tour de Suisse racer of all time. Because he won three of them in a row, and he crushed everybody at the Tour de Suisse every year in that little, in that span where he was really good. He was just the dominant Tour de Suisse racer, and that was his niche, which, you know, who knew that was a niche? But it was his.
Moving on from Rui Costa.
I think we can move on from Strada. I feel like we've really, we've Monday morning DS'd Strada pretty well. I don't know if non-American football fans are going to kind of get what that means. In American football, the games are played on Sunday, and on Monday people talk about what happened, and we call them Monday morning quarterbacks. Yeah, we're Monday morning DSing here. That's what we've done for the last 40 minutes, 50 minutes.
Should we talk Paris-Nice?
Yeah, so as of record time, we've got one stage of Paris-Nice in the books, and I actually thought it was, first of all, it was entertaining, and second of all, we had a lot to talk about for it being a sprint stage. I think by the time we do another show, assuming Kaylee lets us do another show, we will have a lot more to talk about with Paris-Nice.
Assuming enough people sign up. That's really that's really where we're at.
So, but really, just go do that, please, because we want to do another show. We've had one stage of Paris-Nice. We'll have a lot more to talk about with the next show, but the one stage of Paris-Nice did give us, I think, maybe two talking points. For starters, Soudal Quick-Step, the lead out, I think is, it's going strong, unsurprisingly probably, but I thought they did a great job of putting Tim Merlier into position to win today's stage, and that's a team that I think shows if the lead out's really good and the sprinters are really good, you're going to win a lot of bike races, and they've done that already. This was his fourth win, Merlier, after today. The other big thing from Paris-Nice I thought was very interesting for the first stage is that Tadej Pogacar was, he was in the mood to show off how strong he was, and I really liked that. He went hunting for some bonus seconds, and he got them. Got a pretty substantial. He got a 6-second lead already over most of his rivals, and I loved that. It's Paris-Nice, and he's out there doing his thing.
Pogacar really seems to want to make bike racing exciting to watch, sort of regardless, and maybe even to his own detriment in terms of results. And I'm totally here for that. I'm 100% okay with him having fewer palmares and making more people, you know, find a relatively mundane first stage of a relatively mundane stage race interesting. Not to erase the excitement of a sprint.
I applaud him.
But, yeah.
Absolutely applaud him.
We should also applaud Nielsen Palace, because Nielsen Palace definitely got up there and got active today. So good on Nielsen. He's done a lot in the last couple of weeks, and I'm just really excited to talk about American racers on podcasts, because, like, I don't know, we generally on the men's side don't have that opportunity as often as the women's side. So yeah, hooray Nielsen Palace for trying something. He didn't really make much of it, but he tried, and you know,
he was out there for a while.
I don't know what he was doing though. Like, he looked really strong, but I didn't know. I was like, couldn't you be doing this at a different time? I don't know. It's day one.
He did get the KOM points though, right?
Yeah. Okay.
He did that.
Yeah.
It was after that that it didn't make any sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Then he was just kind of out there,
chasing potatoes. Did Pog get 6 seconds right?
Yeah, 6 seconds. Mm-hmm.
That could be really relevant later, because. Yeah. There's a team time trial in this Paris-Nice, and I don't know if you've looked at Jonas Vingegaard's team here at this Paris-Nice, but it is terrifying from a team time trial perspective, and I can't imagine UAE is going to be able to match that. So I think Pog is going to need every single second he can possibly get here.
I assume that Roglic also imagined that Pog wouldn't match his time trial at the Tour de France that one time. So never say never.
True.
But yeah, I agree. I think and Vingegaard didn't get any time. He was fourth, I think, on that climb, so he just missed the bonus seconds. So I don't know, a really, really nice job by UAE to kind of snatch those 6 seconds. By the time we're doing this next weekend, assuming we're doing this next weekend, we'll be able to talk about who won, and we'll have all kinds more Monday morning DS to do for Paris-Nice. Meanwhile, also, obviously, because it's Paris-Nice time, Tirreno Adriatico is about to kick off. So that's what you have to look forward to this week. You get both Paris-Nice and Tirreno. Before we go too much farther into that last little bit of the show, the sort of the mini Recon Ride, where we're going to look ahead just to see what's coming up. I wanted to point out two little news stories. First of all, Caleb Ewan, another photo finish in which he did not win today.
He won, just to be clear.
He was announced as the winner. Caleb Ewan?
No. Ewan was announced as the loser, was he not?
Yeah. He was announced as the winner, and then he was given the loss.
Yeah but he actually won. So he just posted a bunch of, like, I don't know who sent him these photos, but he just posted a bunch of photos on Twitter from different angles where it is very obvious that he won that bike race.
Whoa. So that seems, we should talk about that. What's happening there? Who do we call?
Basically, the race, the finish line camera was really low quality, and, you know, the pixels didn't work. Like, it wasn't even really lined up with the finish line. Classic move. And you can't tell. You just straight up can't tell. And, you know, I don't know, that they thought, who's the guy that they ended up handing it to? Gerben Tyson.
Yes, Gerben there Tyson. We go. Gerben Tyson.
And which we're definitely saying wrong. I apologize to Gerben. But yeah, like I said, Ewan tweeted these photos where they're kind of from, like, the front and to the right a little bit. And so you can't really, like, you can't line up the wheels, right? But you can see that one of them is just like 3 or 4 inches further over the line than the other.
I feel like you should say something. You should.
They're pretty compelling, but again, like, what do you do? I mean, we talked about this on the placeholders before. Like, at some point, I think it should be a tie. If you don't know, then both of them won. And I know that's deeply, deeply unsatisfying to a sprinter who's like, I don't want that. But, like, if you can't tell, you can't tell. I feel like that's a that's what they do in skiing. Like, the timing goes to a thousandth, and if you are tied to a hundredth of a second, then you are tied.
If only there was some sort of governing body to have rules that every race with their certification would have to follow for finish line cameras. And
alas. Well, right. I mean, I feel bad for Caleb Ewan because he's lost every single photo finish that I can think of as of late, and in fact this one he actually won and yet still lost
in real time. I'm looking at these photos, and man, I feel bad. So he tweeted, I kind of think I won, thoughts, with a photo of him kind of looking like he won. It's close. I kind of agree with him. For the real, like, to really make it worse, I think they did announce him as the winner, and then they took it away, which is a real bummer.
I've been in a situation like this, and it is really not a fun situation.
When was this?
It was Provence-Afil a few years ago, and Vollering and I were in a photo finish, and I thought she had won, and so I came to the podium to be, like, second place, and then they were like, no, you won, and then somebody else came and said, no, you didn't win, and then they were like, no, you did win, and I was like, I don't care if I got first and second anymore, but I just need to not keep with the chopping and changing, all right?
Is there like,
and
a team attorney?
I did win, but I don't, there's just, like, too many, you know, people that don't have an opinion, well, do have an opinion about it, and it's just so close. I agree, ties should be a thing, because it's just silly.
Is there
at some point it's silly.
Does your director, like, go to is there some sort of process, at least, to, like, appeal this or to get details on it? I mean
it's all up to the commissaires, the judges on the day. It's the lead commissaires at the end of the day, their decision. They get to make the call, but they get to take their time doing it, and there's a lot of people speculating around while they're making that decision that come to you and tell you different things. Yeah.
Can we start a fake controversy here?
This is a real controversy. Yeah, we don't even have to start it. This, to me, seems like, you know.
I'm just saying this race was in Belgium and they gave it to the Belgian guy.
But it was part of the Lotto series.
That's true, and races for the Lotto
team. Rides for, which makes me wonder, why doesn't the Lotto series have better cameras? Because, like, come on.
Buy more lottery tickets.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, bummer for Caleb Ewan. I'm pretty sure he won that bike race. But it's also cool to see him racing well. He's been sort of in and out. And if he appears, as he appears to have done, actually won this bike race, then that's a good stepping stone for him, I think.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so one more minor note. Ineos today. So Geraint Thomas not going to race Torino Adriatico. He had an infection. Egan Bernal hurt his knee, what was it, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago now, so he's not at Paris-Nice. And I think it's just worth pointing out that it has not been the season start for the GC guys over at Ineos the way they would have hoped, even if the decent cyclocross and mountain bike guys are having a good year so far.
Bernal did ride, what is it? I saw a Strava ride of his just yesterday. He rode like 130 miles and climbed 17.
His Strava is like, it's wild. Like,
yeah, so what's that? He rode like 200 something K and climbed 5,000 meters or something like that. So I think the knee's okay.
Yeah.
but clearly not good enough to come back and race Paris-Nice just yet. But, yeah. Good to see him out doing big rides. He's not like permanently damaged or anything.
All right, last but not least, Cosmo and I used to do big previews of bike races. And I think we're going to mostly focus on not doing huge long previews of bike races. But we should at least tell you, yes, there's more Paris-Nice to come. So you should tune in. You got all of Tirreno Adriatico coming up, and if you look at the start list, it's interesting. I feel like there was a period where Paris kind of cornered the market on the classics stars, and now if you look at Tirreno, it's got quite a few of them. There's that Matthew Vanderpool guy. There's Tom Pidcock. He's a guy. There are some impressive GC types that are going to that race as well, but I think it's going to be really cool to watch some of those classics riders as they gear up for the classics, which are right around the corner. I mean, E3 and Gent-Wevelgem are, what, 3 weeks away? Less than 3 weeks away at this point? So that should be a fun one. Definitely worth tuning in. It doesn't have a team time trial like Paris-Nice has, which inherently makes it a better race because team time trials are stupid and worthless.
I love team time trials.
We can talk about that later in the year. But we don't have to go into it. Maybe we'll save that conversation. We've
out of time
had
today, but I will not forget that.
I feel like we've gone over this. I know Cosmo and I have gone over this before.
I hate individual time trials, but team time trials are sweet.
Terrible. lastly, on the calendar, Ronda van Dretta is next weekend. So by the time we're recording our next show, we'll be able to talk about that, which is, I'm pretty stoked about that. That's a real chance to see some actual classics racing at the World Tour level. And it's a race that tends to be, I think, a pretty indicative race of form. And that's going to be on March 11th in the Netherlands. Hopefully a good one. We'll see what happens. And we'll have that to talk about as well when we come back, if we come back, for the next episode of the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast from the Escape Collective Podcast Network. I think that's it, though, for this week, unless there's something I missed. Have I missed anything?
No. People just need to sign up.
People need to sign up.
Escapecollective.cc. Go sign up. You support this podcast. You support the rest of our podcasts. You support a whole bunch of pretty fantastic journalists with an effort that is membership-driven, membership-led. We're working for you now instead of working for a whole pile of endemic advertisers. And that feels really good as somebody who makes content. It allows us to say no to things that we don't like, and that's what independence is. So that's us. Sign up if you believe in it, and sign up if you like this podcast. Because I wish I was kidding, but I'm not kidding when I say that. Like, if we can't make this work, every single one of us has to go find another job somewhere. It's just the reality. We got bills to pay. So this is a big moment for the whole crew here.
Yeah, I really don't want to do that. So please sign up.
No.
Because actually, I love talking bike racing. I love talking to Kayla about bike racing. I like hearing Cosmo talk about bike racing. And it's pretty sweet that we get to just like, oh, hey, it's former U.S. national champion Ruth Winder. We get to have a conversation about bike racing. And we can only do that if you guys sign up. I actually, for one little note, I mean, we do want to make sure that people are aware. If you don't sign up, there won't be opportunities for Cosmo to go on rants about things on the podcast. And actually, we didn't really get that this show because I think we're trying to save it a little bit. We very briefly mentioned the Vanderpool, maybe getting a little too much TV time. But hopefully by the next show, we'll have more support for a big rant, which is what I really want. Yeah.
I was going to say, if you don't like the podcast, also sign up. And then you can say, Kaylee, I gave you money. Please get rid of this podcast and get a better one. So either way, You should be signing up.
Yep.
All right. Well, I think that's it for us this week. Thank you for joining. Thank you for listening to the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast, and hopefully we'll see you next week.
Bye, everybody.